So how many people were here last week? Good. Do you remember what I talked about? What? This is like, I feel like a class and I'm a teacher. What? Happiness. Right. Remember happiness? You know, I shared some of the wonderful quotes of Thich Nhat Hanh about happiness. Makes it seem so simple. Happiness is always available. Happiness is available in the here and now. We have all the conditions right now to be happy, right? So, you know, sounds wonderful. But so we sort of kind of looked at it. And one of the things, of course, we did last week, and again, you can listen to the talk. I believe they're all online. You know, we help people. We did a lot of reflection, you know, really like happiness is a word, but how do I know that I'm happy? You know, what is the feeling tone within myself that lets me know when I'm happy? And basically, you know, what came out as we kind of worked it was a sense of ease, a sense of contentment, a sense of equanimity with whatever's happening. So, which is good, you know, I might call that generally a sense of well-being, right? And then we also looked at how do you know you're unhappy? And of course, people were able to identify, you know, feeling tones within themselves, within their own body, mind, that let them know that I'm not happy. Which could not only be, you know, I'm angry, I'm irritated, I'm anxious, I'm sad, I'm depressed, you know, all that kind of more obvious mental affliction, but also, you know, the mind's not at ease, it's agitated, it's restless. So there's lots of ways of, but people were very clear. We know when the mind is happy in a state of well-being, and we know when the mind is not. And that's very important. I mean, it has to start there, right? Because if we're not able to identify our own feeling states and able to correctly label them and to distinguish one from another, then it's very hard or almost impossible to change and transform. So it's very important, you know, that we have this capacity to know ourselves. And of course, in our tradition, you know, what we utilize is mindfulness and meditation. So this is like the ground. If we want to be happy and not unhappy, to experience within ourselves a state of well-being and not a state of ill-being, we have to know what these states are and when they're arising in us. We have to correctly label. So this is really the first step, and this is really the key piece of mindfulness meditation, is to really understand our minds and understand what's going on with our minds, but also to give us criteria. Many of us don't have criteria. We think, and we talked about this last week, we think all these kinds of mind states of anxiety and worry and anger and irritation and, you know, are normal, you see. In a certain sense, they are normal, in the sense they do arise in the course of human life. But to know that we are actually cultivating them is the problem that causes us suffering, that really separates just the arising and passing of a mind state and ones that stay around and really condition our mind. And I talked a lot about the research and, you know, really kind of shared qualities, inner qualities that are needed to be happy, such as to be adaptable, to be resilient, to be able to go with the flow of things, not always be in opposition to life, but to be able to be open to life and to be able to deal with things as they arise from a place of well-being, as opposed from a place of anxiety and anger and despair and sadness, So this kind of resiliency is very important. It also implies a kind of a confidence. In oneself and one's own capacity to deal with whatever arises. So the more confident we have in our own abilities to deal with all the situations of life, the more easily we're willing to be open and adaptable to all the situations of life. So, you know, there are certain qualities, we might say kind of an inner kind of strength that these qualities give us so we can maintain happiness and well-being in our life. But what I want to focus on today is training in happiness. I think this is very important to understand that happiness is not going to fall into our lap. It's something that we need to cultivate and train in. And again, one of the points I made last week, and I'll say it again, because it is so essential, is two kinds of happiness. Worldly happiness, and we might call more intrinsic happiness. Worldly happiness is based on pleasure. And pleasure comes from what? What does pleasure come from? What?
Getting what we want.
Getting what we want. But so it's usually externally driven. So what do we find pleasurable in life?
Stuff.
Getting stuff. What else do we find pleasurable? Having pleasurable experiences, pleasurable relationships, all kinds of things, eating, being with friends, going to Disneyland. Well, it's not always pleasurable. For kids it is. What? Success is pleasurable. So there are all kinds of things in this world that give us pleasure, i.e. happiness. But from a Buddhist point of view, the problem of all of them is they are conditioned objects. What does that mean? That they appear as an object that we seek, and that when we experience it, it gives us pleasure. The problem is that it's always transient and temporary. That is the problem. It's not that Buddhism is negative to worldly pleasure. It says, you know, yeah, it's nice to have pleasurable activities in life, isn't it? It's just part of life. Yeah, that's good. It's good to have sundowns and beaches and good friends and good food if we can have it and all those kinds of good things. The problem is they're all temporary. They all have a short lifespan, right? And so once that object has been experienced, we cannot continually get pleasure from it. Eventually, it's going to recede or disappear. When it recedes or disappears, what is the feeling that we're left with? What? Well, we're often missing. See, we're missing. There's something missing, right? That pleasure was so nice. It was so much fun. The weekend was so great, but now I got to go back to work. Right. So therefore, we are always in this state of having pleasurable experiences disappearing, feeling the unease or the missing of the boredom, the dullness, the flatness, the lack of excitement, the lack of pleasure, right? And therefore, we have to what? We all do it. What do we do? What? Seek more. Seek more. We keep it going. And again, we talked about digital, you know, it's like, and now it's instant, isn't it? I mean, we instantly can access something to that we believe in the moment will give us pleasure. Right? Again, all those pleasures are conditioned by having an experience with something external to us, which is fundamentally undependable, unstable. So we're always in a state of what? Up and down, flux, getting what we want, not getting what we want, happy when we get what we want, unhappy when we're not getting what we want. Always having to work very hard to stay happy. And again, wanting to be happy is a fundamental, you know, we might say is a fundamental aspiration of all human beings, right? You know, I mean, nobody, you know, we don't say to friends, gee, would you like to go and have a kind of miserable time with me on, you know, Saturday night? You know, let's just go out and be miserable together. You know, let's pick the, you know, let's pick the worst restaurant we could think, or choose some band that we hate, and let's go, let's go. Everybody laughs. Why? What? Because we, you know, we're always seeking something pleasurable, something we'll enjoy. And again, there's nothing wrong with that. You know, that's just life. But unfortunately, we live in a world where that has become the pursuit of pleasure, the pursuit of externality, the pursuit of things, money, wealth, status, influence, being known, you know, all those kinds of things are what drives human beings. And fundamentally, from a Buddhist point of view, psychologically, that is fundamentally unsatisfactory. Because it's like this, like this, like this. So as opposed to relying on one's happiness or state of well-being or contentment on external objects, you know, we cultivate qualities that are already inherent, or we have the capacity within our minds to realize and experience. It doesn't mean that we turn away from the world and, you know, these, you know, I'm never gonna go to the beach again, or I'm never gonna listen to good music again, or no. It means I understand there's something deeper. And this deeper sense of well-being can incorporate the ups and the downs. That's what a state of well-being is. That's why a state of well-being and inner contentment, inner peace, allows one to move through the ups and the downs of life, the temporary happinesses, the temporary sadness, the temporary gains, the temporary losses, and never lose that inner sense of well-being or ease or inner contentment. So this is something very different than what's sold to us by our culture, which is it's only by getting something, getting the right relationship, getting the right job, having the right house, you know, getting everything, having the best vacation, getting the right car, then we'll be happy. Learning more, doing more, seeing more, look at this, look at that, this has gone viral, this is, you know, it's like endless. All promising us what? A moment of pleasure or interest. And so we are, you know, just kind of like monkey see, monkey do. Our strings are endlessly pulled. So for those who kind of go, it's not a very satisfying way to live, you know, when we step back from it, like we're doing today, we're stepping back. We're stepping back from the ongoing activity and, you know, energy of our life and movement of our life, and we step back. and we go, is it really giving me what I want? Which is fundamentally, we want to be happy. That's everyone wants to be happy. That's kind of like one of these fundamental things. Ultimately, everybody would like to have inner peace. Well, most people, if you ask them, I'd like to have a peaceful mind. I'd like to have a content mind. I'd like to be more, you know, open and relaxed and at ease in life. Yeah. But these are all inner qualities. These are qualities of our mind, right? Inner peace, inner contentment, inner well-being, right? These are all qualities of mind, and mind is not out there. So if you think you have to go out there to get something you already have, well, you're not only, we call that ignorance in Buddhism. It's not like we're stupid, but we're like ignorant of like what really produces happiness and well-being. And we're chasing after things and spending a lot of time and energy chasing after things that fundamentally will not deliver to us what we already want, but crazily enough, we already have, because they are qualities of mind. They are, or another way to say it, they are potentialities of our mind. So therefore, the kind of inner happiness or well-being which is consistent over time and situation is something that needs to be cultivated or trained in. So has anybody here ever trained in anything? What have you trained in? Piano. Why did you train in piano? Well, because you wanted to become good or better at it. I mean, just sitting down and going, like little kids do, you know, they can make a lot of, they can enjoy banging on the piano, but it doesn't sound too good, right? Okay, so you wanted to improve or at least play music that was satisfying to you. And to do that, you had to train. Who else has trained in anything? Yeah, what have you trained in? Scuba diving. You just one day just decide I'm going to go scuba diving, and you went and got the outfit and you jumped overboard, right? What? You learned it, you trained it, and you had lessons. Because ultimately you wanted to have that experience of going underwater and being able to stay underwater for a while and go deeper than you can usually do, right? So you had to train in how to do that. Who else trained in something? Yes. You wanted to be a medical transcriptionist, and you trained, you put in hours learning, practicing. Anybody else train? Anybody exercise? Have you trained in any, had a trainer or trained in, what have you trained in?
Tai Chi.
Tai Chi, you trained in Tai Chi? Yoga, you trained in yoga. Boxing, you trained in boxing. So you just got in the ring and started slugging, or you trained? What? You trained, you know. If you wanted to become good at boxing, you had to train a little more than the person who didn't really want to become good at boxing, right? Yeah. So training implies a consistency over time, right? But it also implies a frequency. And the frequency really relates to how serious I am about learning this and developing this skill. Everybody in this room has done this. We've trained in something, sport, music, career, right? Profession, right? Everybody has trained. And we know we need to train to get better at, to get the results we want. Anybody disagree with me? This is the time. So it is fascinating. It is unbelievable that we say we want to be happy. We want to have peace of mind. We want to have an inner sense of well-being that's always with us. Would everybody say that's sounds good? The disconnect is what? We don't seriously undertake the training of our minds, the training of our hearts, with the same consistency, application time. So when you were learning boxing, you did it once every 3 months? You did it 10 minutes a day? Were you kind of serious about it for a time?
Well, not.
I mean, you're not a professional boxer. But you did it how often?
Half an hour, an hour a day.
Half an hour, an hour a day, okay? And that was for physical training. Time, consistency, and time. We put a lot of time. How much time do we put in every day to preparing our meals? Not too much. Too much. You know, preparing our meals, eating our meals, cooking our meals, cleaning up from our meals, right? Shopping for our meals. A lot of time, don't we? And then every meal, there's something fascinating about a meal. It's over. You know, it's always fascinating. You put all this work in, and like, you know, 15 minutes into it, it's like over. Gone. And all the effort and all the pleasure that we got from that is gone. And then we have to do it again for the next meal. Right? But we do it consistently. But do we have that same commitment and consistency to taking care of our mind and our well-being? This is where we have a very distorted lifestyle in our culture. This consistent, reinforced through media messages, social messages, cultural messages, you know, to consume, 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 seek, 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 want, 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 desire, 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 is endlessly being reinforced, which makes it difficult to find that time and that energy to do things that, like when we're in our best mind, we consistently say, yeah, this is what I really want. I want to be happy. I want to be content. I want to have a sense of inner contentment and inner well-being and equanimity in life. And I want to be open-hearted, and I want to have good relationships, and I want to, right? And yet we think somehow that's all just going to fall into our lap because we come here on Sundays, because we read the books, because we listen to the podcast, because we talk about it. But the truth is, it only comes about through training, training, training. Any questions about that before we talk a little bit about what we need to train in? Anybody not agree, or any questions? Everybody agrees? Nobody cares? Let me just disabuse us of one notion that's, I think, a major saboteur of this desire to change is many of us feel, however we are, however our heart mind is, we believe that's who we are and we really can't change, right? Or our change can only be, you know, a little, I can change a little bit. But the idea of transformation is not believable to us. As if we are a fixed entity, me, my personality, the way I've been conditioned, my where my life has conditioned me to be. This is who I am, and this is kind of what I'm stuck with. Right? And many people carry that belief either consciously or very unconsciously, and so it's hard for them to really become enthusiastic and energetic about their transformation because they really, truly, deep down, don't believe it's possible for them. We might call this doubt. And it is a major saboteur of anybody who seeks transformation, to doubt. To doubt one's own capacity to change, or to doubt the teachings, let's say within our tradition, I go back to the Buddha, that basically say to us, no, everybody has this pure, original nature, undefiled mind. Everybody has this incredible capacity and has all the seeds and potential they need to manifest themselves, you know, at least in a state of well-being and happiness, that everyone has it. And more importantly, we are not fixed entities. You know, the Buddhist meditators have always known we are not fixed entities. Thoughts, feelings, perceptions, memories are endlessly open to change and transformation because they're not stable. They're not fixed. Endlessly arising and passing. Right. Now, in our psychological tradition of Buddhism, we've always known that. We've always known that because we've used the tools of meditation and deep looking to understand our mind and see the lack of fixedness. But now, you know, 2,600 years later, neuroscientists, cognitive scientists have now come up with this term of neuroplasticity, right? Great discovery. They thought the brain was a fixed thing. And all of a sudden discovered, no, it's endlessly producing, changing, right? So even the brain is not a fixed thing. So we all have this capacity to transform, right? If you have a decent body, you don't have any significant physical problem, can you learn to jog? What do you think? What? Even if you haven't even done it, even if you're terribly out of shape. Anybody ever been terribly out of shape? Raise your hand if you've ever been terribly out of shape. Anybody ever been terribly out of shape and decide to get themselves in shape and sort of submitted to some kind of training regimen and all of a sudden found that things they didn't think they were capable of, they could do? Yeah, I mean, we know this, right? Because we know that unless we have something significantly, and again, the body is a physical thing, the mind is not a physical thing. The body does have its own structures and its mechanics that you know, and has things that can prevent us from doing certain things. But essentially, our bodies have the capacity for movement and motion, and right? So we all have that potential. It's only through intention, aspiration, motivation, and working at training, cultivation, that we realize it, right? Is that clear? We all know that. We can change our bodies, we can change our strength, we can change our endurance just by training. It is the same for our mind. No different at all. A state of well-being, a state of inner contentment, peace of mind, will not come about through the cultivation of afflictive mind states. Right? A healthy, strong body will not come about if all we eat is Cheetos. You agree with me? I mean, there's got to be some correlation with the, what we're feeding our bodies and the way it is developing and, you know, energizing and stuff like that. Okay. In the same way, if we are feeding our mind negativity, anger, resentment, despair, sadness, anxiety, fear, jealousy, envy, impatience, frustration, right? If this is what we are feeding our minds, our hearts, do not expect that we will have any kind of inner peace, inner contentment, or inner well-being. We will have ill-being. No matter how many books we read, no matter how many conversations, no matter how many retreats we go to, if we are not cultivating, or let me just start, if we do not stop cultivating afflictive negative mind states that disturb the well-being of the mind, we will not have a mind of well-being. So there is something we need to stop doing. Why? Because we want to have a healthy mind. We want to have a mind of well-being. We want to have a mind that feels good. Right? Well-being, I feel good. A well body feels good. A well body feel different than a sick body? Yeah. A well mind feels different than an unhealthy mind. And in Buddhism, an unhealthy mind is a mind that is disturbed, that is not at peace, that is not relaxed, that is not open. So we need to be aware that, you know, through mistakenness or unknowingness or ignorance, we have spent a lot of time cultivating mind states, emotional states, that are always actually causing us harm and sabotaging that which we want to achieve. So that has to be very clear. Our mindfulness will reveal to us the mind that's, you know, the train of thought, the type of story, you know, the rumination. Whatever it is that is going on in our mind, if we are aware of it and we can label it correctly, same way we know healthy food from junk food, right? Foods that are nutritious and beneficial for us and foods that really aren't. In the same way we know that, it's how much more important is that we know mind states. Because our happiness, you know, there are lots of people who are very buff and strong and great, but they're not happy people. True? No. There are plenty of people who have lots of money and lots of wealth and lots of beauty and, you know, whatever. They're not happy people. So we need to stop doing things that are sabotaging our happiness and well-being. By mindful awareness, by proper naming and labeling, and then by entering a process. And the traditional way is to immediately apply the antidote, to do something, right? So if I'm, you know, shopping for dinner and, you know, I'm and I see the potato chips and the Cheetos and the, you know, right? quick and easy. But if I catch myself and say, no, I'm trying to change my diet, I'm trying to eat more healthy, I'm trying to do this and that, then we go to where? We go to another aisle, okay? We go to another aisle. We buy things that are good for us. If we stay hungry, we may still go to what we're conditioned to go to, that which is easiest and that which feels most easily accessed. And unfortunately for many of us, our negative mind states are what's most easily accessed. Wholesome mind states are not easily accessed. Why? Because we're untrained. We haven't trained in that. We've been training, for many of us, in afflictive mind states. So the simplest thing to do is whenever we notice we use the afflictive mind state now, to help transform us. Oh, I see you. What is the opposite? What is the antidote to anger? Patience. Understanding. Yeah, yeah. I'm not the only one caught in traffic. Everyone's caught in traffic. It's normal. Relax. Patience. Understanding causes and conditions. You know, the world can't help being the way it is because of causes and conditions. People can't help being the way they are because of their causes and conditions. Just like me. So I generate patience, antidote to anger. I use the irritation or the anger as an opportunity to change. What else? What are the afflictions that disturb our mind? Jealousy. So all of a sudden you see your mind kind of envying somebody else or why them not me, or why do they have this and I don't have that? Okay, what's the antidote? What? Taking joy in the joy of others. No. To be happy for other people. Be happy for their successes. You know, why be jealous? Take joy in the joy of others. Be happy for others' well-being. Immediate shift. What else disturbs our minds?
Fear.
Fear. What's the antidote to fear? What's the antidote to fear? What? Confidence. What? Calm.
Courage.
Courage is very important. You know, we often think of courage as something, you know, that goes on in the battlefield or first responders, you know what I mean? Like, but there's another kind of courage. You know, the courage to show up in life and deal with what's ever happening. That's courage. The willingness not to know how things are going to turn out and yet still go forward. How about that one? Because all anxiety and fear is always future-based, right? We're not anxious and scared about things that have happened from the past. So anxiety and fear is always about something, some danger, something we think we can't handle in the future. People have social anxieties. Anybody even know about social anxieties? Okay. Why do people have social anxieties? What are they worried about? What are they scared about? Judgment. What's the antidote to social anxiety? What? There are a number of things we could do. What's an antidote to social anxieties? To concern about what people think about one. Yeah, I have no idea what people think of me, and what does it matter? Right? I mean, does anybody here ever judge anybody else? Has anybody ever thought unkindly about somebody else? Should they wilt? Should they stay home because of us? No. So why is it so, you know, devastating to us that somebody may, right? So one way is to think that way. Another way is to, you know, have confidence in oneself. Yeah, this is who I am. I'm doing my best. I'm showing up. If people want to judge me, that's okay. It doesn't, you know, having a sense of, a good sense of one's own genuineness and authenticity about who you are, and which is not conditioned what the external world thinks about you. That's a great antidote. So, immediately identifying the antidote, because a healthy mind, a happy mind, is made up of positive qualities. such as patience, such as courage, such as confidence? What happens if we are thinking unkind thoughts about another human being? And we notice it. What's the antidote? Loving kindness. May they be well. May they be happy. They're just like me. Understanding. When we do that, we are now generating wholesome qualities. And the difference with a wholesome mind state and wholesome qualities is it feels good. Anger, bitterness, fear, despair, envy, they disturb the mind. They agitate the mind. Grasping, needing, wanting, very disturbing to the mind. So therefore they're called unwholesome. Wholesome emotions and mind state feel differently. They are supportive and conducive of well-being. So, you know, it's not that hard to learn within yourself, you know, which ones need to be supported. So all those kinds of loving kindness, compassion, right? Many people in the face of suffering, they go down the rabbit hole of despair. Disturbs the mind. Compassion, which is this empathic connection to other human beings that immediately wants to help them if they can, is wholesome. It feels good. Compassion, love, caring, wholesome. Stinginess, generosity, which feels better. We've all felt them, you know. How does it feel when we give? Not just money, give our time, give our support, give kind words to. How does it feel when we are generous with our resources? And I'm not just saying financial, I mean all, even our personal resources. How do we feel when we give? Reinforces immediately a sense of well-being in oneself. When we're closed off, when we judge, when we're restrictive, how does it feel? Not so good. So, to be happy is to train the mind in cultivating the qualities of mind that produce a mind of well-being, and no longer cultivating the ones that don't or disturb. And when I say no longer cultivating, I am not saying that they don't arise. We have been cultivating them for a long, long time. They're still going to arise, but we're not cultivating them, right? So if you're training, you want to train in boxing, pick an extreme case, you want to train in boxing, and you're going to go to the gym to train, do you always feel like going to train? Do you ever feel lazy? Well, yeah. How do you deal with your laziness? Yeah. So he says he works through it. How do you work through it? So you think, see, there's actually something you're doing. You're acknowledging you're lazy, but rather than giving into it, you say to yourself, you get up and go. But why do you get up and go? Because you remind yourself what?
How you feel after.
You remind yourself how you feel after. I always feel better after I do it. Or you remind yourself, this is something I really want to get good in, and I got to really apply my... So we actually are doing this all the time. We all know how to do this. We've just never applied it to the transformation of our own mind and sense of well-being. So again, what am I trying to say? That it's not that hard once you understand the process. And once you have the energy to apply yourself to it, i.e. training, you will transform. Because caring about other human beings, being open to other human beings, these are all qualities that are natural to us. We see them in young children. We see them in young children before stuff has happened to them. But young children are basically what? Their relationship to the world is what? Open. Right? Curious. Fearless. Right? That's why the parents are always offering them, because, you know, they're fearless, right? They're risk takers. You know, they see a closed cupboard door, the first thing they want to do is get into it. You know, they're curious about life. And most of them, when they see other human beings, they what? Smile. They smile. And if you take care of their basic needs, you know, making sure, you know, change their diapers and, you know, feed them enough and all that, and make sure, you know, get their sleep, they are generally what? Happy. I mean, they'll play with anything. You know, give them a couple of little Tupperware things and they're in heaven. Right? You know what I mean? You know, put them in a little tub of water. You know, they're in bliss. It doesn't take much to make them happy, does it? No. I mean, it's incredible. Natural happiness. Capacity to be present to life, open to life. Right? We need to train ourselves. Many of us, because of the things that have happened, we've closed off, we've separated. We have walls, we have barriers. We can transform. We didn't start out that way. That's all been conditioned. The mind is plastic, plasticity. It can change. It can reform. Right? You know, there's a lot of science now. You're probably all aware of it. You know, people, brain scientists have done all kinds of studies on meditators. Yeah. You know, between the baseline non-meditators and the meditators, very different looking mind. Very different looking brain waves, whatever goes on in the brain. Yeah, very different. Then I want to open this question. Let me say something about meditation. Many people equate meditation with focusing on your breath. Meditation is a methodology for becoming familiar with and understanding your mind. That's why we meditate. So when we think about cultivation of wholesome mind states, please include in your meditation becoming more familiar with wholesome mind states. How about this for a new idea? That's actually very beneficial, especially for people like us who live in the world and live in relationship. Yesterday, Angie and I did a morning workshop on relationships, creating harmonious relationships. We, as human beings, we live in relationship to other human beings. If we want to live in harmony and well-being with other human beings, it's good to cultivate in our mind what kind of mind states. What? Positive, such as gratitude. Anybody ever have a moment of feeling grateful as opposed to feeling not grateful? How do you feel not grateful? How come, you know, why does anybody do anything for me? Or why doesn't anybody thank me? Or, you know. Right? How do you feel when you're not grateful? Happy? Oh, bad, bad, bad. But when you feel grateful, when you remember the kindness of another human being or somebody who's helped you out along the way, or, you know, how do you feel? Grateful. When you're just grateful to life, or you're grateful to the day, or, wow, grateful for a day off, you know, how do you feel? Good. Right? Great. Gratitude feels good. What other kinds of things could we be cultivating in meditation beside gratitude? Generosity. Reflecting. What else? Come on. Kindness. Loving kindness. compassion, empathy. In Buddhism, we cultivate what we call the four immeasurables, right? Loving kindness, compassion, taking joy in the joy of others. Actually, it's what we do on Wednesday nights. So, because it's understood that we need to familiarize our mind with these wholesome ways of thinking, the same way we have familiarized our minds over the years or decades with very negative, unwholesome ways of thinking. Now we know I can just retrain my mind. So meditation is a wonderful process, because to do it, we have to place these thoughts in our mind, and we have to be able to concentrate on them. Right? So when we're practicing mindfulness of the breath or the body, whatever you're practicing, we're learning basically the skills of mindful concentration, learning to hold the mind on something. But it's very beneficial to use these skills to meditate on loving kindness and compassion and patience, and, you know, the suffering of beings. Right? If you want to open your heart, meditate on the suffering of human beings or animals in this world. Right? And you don't do that to despair. You do that to think, oh, so many people suffer in this world. Build empathy. And then we generate the wish, how can I help them? And not the people across the world who are suffering, but the people within my own life, with my own family, circle of friends, colleagues, myself. If you perceive your suffering, I have compassion for myself. So these qualities can be cultivated. And the end result is an inner state of well-being, of inner knowing, of stability. I mean, there are many other practices in Buddhism about the nature of the mind and the empty nature of mind and self that are also beneficial for creating this inner stability. But that's another talk. It doesn't mean that this happiness that we're inner cultivating is separate from the ups and downs of the world, of our life. It means we can move through the ups and downs. Again, the successes and the failures, the things that work out and the things that don't work out. With an inner ease and well-being, we're not disturbed. Our mind is big enough that we can incorporate everything in life. But our sense of inner happiness and well-being is not based on the ups and downs in life, because I have understood that I can train my own mind in cultivating the wholesome qualities that support the mind of well-being. Are we clear? Yeah, see how simple it is? Now all we have to do is what? Train. There's the rub. So, train, we have to do all the things that we've done in other parts of our life. We have to be very clear what our goals are. We have to be very clear what our strategy is. We have to, be enthusiastic in our application and consistent. If all those things that we already know from other parts of our life we use here, we will see results. And this is the most important thing, because we can't control the external world, even our own bodies are great sources of suffering to us. Can you believe that? This body that we take such care of and dress and wash and brush its teeth and feed, and we do all these things, care about how it looks, dresses it. Even though we do all those good things for it, what does it do? What? It deteriorates. Can you believe it? What? It deteriorates. It has accidents. It gets old. It hurts, right? Last night we were with family and people from out of town, and we took a lot of good Chinese food takeout and had a wonderful meal. Afterwards, everybody sitting around go, "Oh, I'm feeling so full." you know. And then the dessert comes out, and all of a sudden the same people who a minute ago were saying, I'm feeling so full, are just going to... And then they're saying, "Ooh, I really..." There it is, right? Any questions about application? Anything not clear? Online, just chat in.
Online, Libby Dunn asks, are there practices to train in fearlessness?
Are there practices to train in fearlessness? You know, fear... Well, first of all, I think there's practices to train in confidence, okay, which is going about it the other way. I think, let's just everybody close their eyes. And just reflect for a moment. Have I ever had challenges in my life? Growing up, as a teenager, 20s, 30s, 40s, depending how old you are, have I ever had challenges in my life? Things that were difficult for me. Either very practical things, challenging things, you know, physically, mentally, emotionally. Things that I might have... maybe doubted my ability to handle. And then reflect, how did I get through it? How did I rise to the challenge? How did I deal with whatever was holding me back? How have I succeeded at anything in this life? How have I broke through anything? If I haven't had a certain level of courage and resiliency within me to take on the challenges, the difficulties. Sometimes, you know, some of us have maybe had to deal with really difficult situations, fearful situations, dangerous situations, right? And yet, been able to do that. So when we reflect this way, again, this is meditation, becoming familiar, we begin to touch into this capacity that we all have to deal with things where we don't know the outcome, or they appear to be very difficult or risky or whatever, and yet we got through it. Knowing that should give us confidence. But we often have to reflect very deliberately on that, because perhaps like this person was asking, we tend, you know, we have very screwed up minds. Has anybody ever noticed that? We tend to dwell on the negative. You know, we might have had lots of successes in our life, but what do we remember? Our failures, right? You see what I'm saying? You know, we may have gotten through all kinds of difficulty and challenges and faced things in life, but when we think about when the next one comes up, we remember, you know, we're anxious. So the person who said social anxiety and fear about people judgment, in spite of you having that, have you ever, you know, submitted yourself to being around other people? Have you survived the encounters? What? Yeah, of course. And yet, we still carry around this thought, ooh, I wonder what they think about me. I hope they don't think I'm a this or a that. Right? It's because we are distorted in the way even we remember our life, or the way we filter it. You know, we unfortunately are very skewed to the negative, right? Not what we have, but what we're missing. Not what's good in my life, but what's bad in my life. There is nobody who gets through life, unless you were, I don't know, what they used to say, born with a silver spoon, you know what I mean? You just had to come in and you had all the wealth and the ease and you had lots of servants or something, you know, run interference for you in life. You know, most of us have had to deal with things in life. And whether we've dealt well with them or not well, we've all gotten through them. And that's important to recognize that we've done that. To become very conscious that we all have these abilities to adapt and deal with things. That's courage. You know, somebody who is courageous and brave is not somebody who does not know fear. Right? They know fear, but they don't let it cripple them. They don't let them hold them back. Right? They work with their fear. They accept their fear, and yet they go forward. That's how you build strength. Any other questions? Yeah, and then we should stop. It's almost noon. Okay. One more, and then we'll stop.
So I have a tendency when speaking to my partner about something that's bothered her to immediately try and find a solution and help her find happiness. Mm-hmm. And she's helped me realize that that's more harmful than good. Mm-hmm. In our relationship.
Oh, yeah. So therefore,
so I'm wondering, a practice for me or anybody else that deals with that, trying to find a solution or immediately make the person happy.
Right. So Jaron, can other people make you happy? Or can other people support your happiness?
Support.
Yes. Your wife is just like you. She has a mind. She has her own conditioning. She has her own mental fabric, positive and wholesome, negative, unwholesome. She has her past just like you. She's just like you. When you see that she's suffering, you feel what?
Pain.
Well, you feel empathy. That's how you feel empathy. It's important that we feel empathy. It's like you look at her and you know that she's suffering. So I think the place to begin is just to say to her, whatever you call her, I'm aware that you're suffering. My dear, okay. Is there anything that I can do to help you? You ask a question. You don't go barging in with solutions. When you go barging in with solutions, what goes on? Right? So this is very important. We can be empathetic to other human beings, but we have to accept that, you know, her suffering is part of her own causes and conditions. And you, as somebody who cares about her, would say, is there anything I can do to help you, support you in this moment? She's got to find her way through, right? Yeah, I think it's very important that we offer, you know, our kindness, our support, but not start telling people what to do. Everybody like when somebody tells you what to do? We don't like it. But if we ask, and then we find some helpful things, we're grateful. But you see, there's got to be that receptivity. Okay?
Thank you.
So we will stop here.